Occasionally, we do have, you know, some high page count readings. You know, my advice would be to look ahead. I'm starting to put the page counts in my reading schedule so that students can kind of at a glance see that. And so I don't think I've done that for this course yet. My recommendation would be on the weekend, since I hope I've convinced some of you to print maybe, but on the weekend, why don't you just look ahead for the whole of next week's reading and just manage it that way? Because what's really going to kill you is the Tuesday to Thursday, right? So if you get, I'm really sorry, it was just a lot of reading, especially without warning, and coming between Tuesday and Thursday. So, sorry about that. But wasn't it fascinating reading? Sorry. And then it's like a lot of history, which I know, you know, I'd have trouble with history too, because there's so much detail in historical, right? How many of you love reading history? I actually do like reading it. I just don't want to ever be tested on it, because I don't retain a lot of detail the way historians, you know how historians can just like get that detail right where they need it. I'm not like that. So I'm gonna just point out what you need from this. I'll remind you that, you know, in a course without a final exam, a lot of what you're doing when you read and take notes in class is, you know, you're trying to figure out where things are so that if you have to go back to them to answer a question, you've got kind of a roadmap. And you're also trying to create a mental roadmap of the ideas, right? But not because there's going to be some final exam where we test your memory of this. That's what I used to do many years ago. And memory tests have their place. There's no question about that. But my point is that when we have a long reading like that, do the same thing you would do anyway, which is to keep an eye out for the main things. I'm going to ask you fairly easy quiz questions right now because of the length of the reading. But count on us to clarify in class and work with the things that, you know, a skeleton of the reading. And then your notes from class can kind of point you back to places in the reading such that if you have to go back there to think about something that was interesting to you, you've got a little roadmap, you've got a little breadcrumb trail. So for example, in today's work, you know, we're starting, some of you will be very interested as Christians or as people with strong faith commitments in how happiness occurs in religious traditions and how it changes in the first 14 centuries of Christianity, which is what, you know, you could complain 65 pages, but you know, it's covering 14 centuries, for goodness sakes, that's pretty good on a page per century basis, right? So do your best to cover that and try to create a little bit of a mental map, and then when you need to go back and reflect on this more, you kind of know how to get back to the key parts of the readings that you want to think about. Okay. A couple of things before we get started, though, I have some books. I love showing books to people. We have some book group candidates here. Some of these have been used in the past. Some of them are new candidates, so I'll just kind of pass these around and introduce them. Hector and the Search for Happiness is probably well known now because it was a movie. How many of you noticed the movie? No? Okay. Well, this is a book that was written by a French psychiatrist some years ago. It became very popular. It's been translated into a lot of languages. It's insightful. You know, I really liked it. 2002, so it's been out for a while. It's been a pretty popular book group book. It's short, readable, kind of entertaining, and makes some insightful points. So you follow this character, Hector, around the world. We're going to talk later in the semester about Stoicism. We're going to read some Stoicism. We're going to read a contemporary Stoic talking about Stoicism as a philosophy of happiness. As you know, probably Stoicism is a late Greek philosophy. It comes in the Hellenistic period, so long after classical Greek philosophers are dead and gone. But Stoicism is a perennial philosophy. So, you know, for 2,000 years in the West and even in the East, people have been writing Stoic treatises. This is a contemporary one. It's kind of a popular one and seems pretty well done. You might want to know more about Stoicism before you get interested in that book, but you could certainly do it the other way around. We don't do as much sociology in this course as I maybe would like to, but we do read a philosopher who's kind of sociologically oriented, Alain de Botton. But we're only going to read a few pages of this book, Status Anxiety. So if some of you are intrigued by the problems of happiness caused by social comparison and how we compare ourselves to others, This would be kind of a neat and very, if you flip through it, you'll see kind of how it's organized. It's really pretty engaging. And he's a pretty interesting character, too. He's a popular philosopher, and if you look up his stuff, he's got a really neat video on Stoicism. Maybe I'll promote that when we get to that. So that could be a book group book. And then this one I know very little about. This is a fairly new book. I haven't worked with it. It looks kind of cool. It has a cool cover. It has a second cover for some reason. I don't know why. But it does have to do with control and predictability. And so since that came up in our reading today, I kind of pulled it off the shelf and thought, no, maybe this book would be interesting. It's fairly recent. And finally, I'm not recommending this one as a... reading group book. It's a little bit of a tome. But it just came in. I got it for the library, and this is a really cool book. This book's been anticipated for some time. It's by this guy Robert Sapolsky, who's professor of biology and neurology at Stanford University, recipient of a MacArthur Foundation Genius Grant. Really smart guy. He has great facial hair. He's written books called The Primate's Memoir, The Trouble with Testosterone, Why Zebras Don't Get Ulcers. And now, it sounds like an interesting guy, right? And you gotta check out his beard, man. It's just fantastic. I'm envious. And now this book is about, it's about human behavior, especially having to do with right and wrong. But as I was browsing through it, I can't wait to start reading it. It has a lot about the neurology of the dopamine cycle, which is an object of a lot of interest because it's part of the pleasure response cycle we get from doing things that give us rewards. And so there's a lot of brain science in here. And so since we're starting the cognitive psychology today of Daniel Gilbert, it kind of made a connection for you. I just wanted to pass it around just so you can get a sense of, this is kind of pretty cutting edge research relevant to kind of understanding who we are and in ways that are relevant to happiness. You gotta love this one chapter called Adolescence or Dude, Where's My Frontal Cortex? So I don't know what to make of that. But just browse it if you're curious, and it's a kind of literature that's very current now. And like the Gilbert that we're starting, it's relevant to thinking about happiness because we need to know about our brains. We're talking about happiness for humans, and that means happiness for human brains. Okay, so that was my little show and tell. Okay, any questions before we get going? A reminder, let's see, let me get to my little reminders. A reminder that I said this the first day of class, but I want to remind you of it because it can come in handy in your preparation. You might remember that I said that at the bottom of the wiki page you'll find class notes from last year. And while there are new readings coming in, I'll tell you about some in a minute, and there's things that get switched around, it's substantially the course from last year. So you might want to take a peek at the class notes. Does that make sense? Can we get our nonverbal turned on here? Good. Lock in. Eye contact. So you might want to just a piece of advice in preparation. If I were doing the course like you, I'd pull it up and kind of look at the notes before I did the reading, after I did the reading, whatever your preference is. Okay. On the main wiki page, I'll just point this out now, and maybe there'll be more things coming. I'll put things that are kind of current that I'm finding related to happiness. If you guys come across things related to happiness, send me links and I'll post them here. One thing I'm doing is updating at the end of the course. You may notice there are a couple of days that still need readings, and so what I'd like to do is cycle in this topic that I've treated before, and the topic is happiness and public policy. And some of you who do politics, international relations, economics, might really be interested in this. And basically it concerns what measures we use in a society to assess the well-being of that society, right? And so the traditional measures that we all focus on are measures like GDP, because growing economies are happy economies, and so keeping an eye on GDP is important, right? It's going to affect possibly the kinds of job opportunities you guys have in the next couple of years, right? So are we all in favor of GDP at the moment? Okay, good. I mean, GDP has problems, but your bigger problem is when it starts to shrink. So that's the traditional measure for economists, or a traditional measure. But really, starting in the early 2000s, this happiness research was getting the attention of public policy experts and economists, because happiness research gives us other measures for asking how well a society's doing. And when I started teaching happiness, you know, the economists faculty I know and economists you read about their reactions to the happiness literature, and there was a lot of disdain, because economists are pretty hard-nosed folks in general, many of them. And so the idea of like talking about a society measured in terms of happiness was like too much for a lot of them. But now here we are in 2017, and what I wanted to point out, I'm starting to do some research to update these readings. So I've got some good readings, but they're more from the early 2000s, and this has been a pretty active area in happiness research. And so I just started doing some trolling around to see what the latest books and things are on happiness and public policy would be the search term. And there's this cute little 5-minute video from the London School of Economics. Not terribly informative, but a good way, good introduction to the topic. But what's cool about it is, back 10 years ago, the London School of Economics wouldn't have had anything to do with happiness research. Maybe 15 years ago. It would have just been considered too soft, too fluffy. And now they've got this big program on well-being. So I point that out because it's an indication of how mature happiness studies has become. We have a lot of research now that's useful to people who are thinking about the well-being of their community. So you have political scientists and economists and politicians paying attention to happiness measures because they might be in some ways more useful measures than GDP. So we're going to do that right at the end of the course. I just mentioned that because there's a link there. Some of you might be interested in watch that little video. And then I will post things you guys send me and things I come across, because I guarantee you that at least 20% of you will come across some interesting link related to happiness. This, you know, you're just primed for it. So, okay. Well, let's get into our content. And, oh, I'm sorry, we need to do a quiz. So I have 3 really easy quiz questions for you. If you would just pull that form up on the wiki or use a piece of paper, that would be wonderful. Okay, are we ready? My voice is a little scratchy. Are you guys having problems with your voice because of the smoke? So here we go. How about 1? A scout's honor. No, flip to your notes. Don't text with people, obviously. Okay. 2. Okay, I'll just cycle through them again. 1. Okay, go ahead and submit the form. If you're doing this on paper, send the paper forward. Okay, great. Okay, let's answer them. Perpetua and Felicitas were both martyrs. Yeah, both martyrs. Phineas Gage was a very unlucky fellow, right? Okay, good. In the case of Phineas Gage, we learned that you can survive damage to the prefrontal lobe, but it may change your personality, true or false? True. Right, okay. Okay, thanks a lot.
Wait, what was two, sorry.
Sure, that's fine. Phineas Gage suffered a brain injury, so C. Okay, great. All right. Now, you know, I really do appreciate that history is a difficult literature for a lot of folks these days. I mean, it's often long, it's very detailed. You often encounter a lot of names and places that you're not familiar with. But let me just lift a kind of outline or skeleton of key points from this chapter so that you have them in your notes and you can kind of go back to the chapter if you need to. Because there's some really cool things here. And just to get started, I mean, the three themes in today's class, and two of them relate to this chapter. I think we need to appreciate how powerful visions of happiness are for human beings. In other words, when humans fix on a model, an image of happiness, and they commit themselves to it the way people commit themselves to a religion, the power is incredible. People will die for their conception of happiness. Am I right? And we certainly have an example in this case today. Second theme today is really the historicity of happiness, which means we need to appreciate how radically different conceptions of happiness are across cultures and time, especially across time. So now we get to the sample in only 60 pages, 1,400 years of Christian thought on happiness. Quite a bargain when you think about it, on a page per century. But what we need to get from this, the significance we need to draw from this, is we need to appreciate that happiness is a moving target. In history, the humans are moving targets in history. We're not the same creatures as the ancient Greeks, and our cultures aren't the same. There's a kind of continuity there, but there's a kind of radical change over the course of the 2,000 years that we're going to be sampling from during our course, both East and West. So the historicity of happiness comes out today. The other thing that comes out today, and it really relates more to the Gilbert reading, is the capacities that you need to have the problem of happiness. Let me explicate that. But capacities for happiness, in other words, what capacities do you have to have as an organism to have the human problem of happiness? You know, your pet has a different happiness problem than you have, am I right? I assume you don't. I hope. I mean, they overlap. I mean, you like a nice, snuggly bed, too, you know, and so does your pet. But, and you like a nice bowl of food. Not on the floor, maybe, but, you know. I mean, there really are some distinct capacities to human happiness. So, what do we need to have cognitively, emotionally, to have the problem of happiness? Okay. All right, so that's going to come out in the Gilbert reading one. Okay, please interrupt me. I know today's class does involve a fair amount of talking on my part. I don't see an obvious place for a small group discussion, so I wouldn't just kind of make one up. But I do feel like these are topics and there's material here that you guys probably have some reactions to and some questions about. So don't let the lecture style today keep you from interjecting or raising questions. Okay, it makes it a lot more interesting for all of us. All right, so let's just say a little bit about the Roman part, okay?
You might take your homework.
Oh, you can, sure.
Okay. Leave it here.
Yeah. Okay. There's just a little. The first part of this chapter just has a little bit on Roman models of happiness. Let's just say a couple of things about that together. And if you have the text, I'm still encouraging you to find a way to come to class with the text, either electronically or in print. here's the key. Here's what I find interesting about the Roman, the discussion of Roman culture of happiness. And then you guys come in with things that you think about it. Two things, really. First, Roman conceptions of happiness prior to Christianity were very earthy. Can we say that from our reading? They were very focused on material and physical conditions of happiness. The image of the cornucopia comes out of Roman culture, right? The cornucopia is a kind of horn of plenty, a kind of basket represented as an image of abundance. Felicitas, you learn in this chapter, Felicitas was worshipped as a goddess in Roman culture. So the first thing to notice is that pre-Christian Roman culture has this focus on fertility, sexuality, power, abundance, material abundance. And Romans were, they had a state religion, but Romans did not interiorize a kind of, their state religion was very formal. It wasn't a highly affective religion like Christianity. So that was kind of the Roman image of happiness in that period, and we associate it with this concept of living for the day, carpe diem, right? Which some of you associate with that old movie that I guess you still watch, right? Do some of you watch the Dead Poets Society? That still makes it around, doesn't it? This idea of living for the day. And so that's kind of a secular ideal of happiness. The second point I draw out from the Roman section here is it's interesting how humans often imagine happiness as an idyllic contrast to their to whatever they're experiencing. Let me put it more succinctly. Roman ideals of happiness, we imagine happiness often as a contrast to what we're experiencing. Happiness is often a kind of fantasy which takes us away from the negative things that we're experiencing in our lives. So in the Roman case, you have a wealthy Roman culture, in, especially in the city of Rome, but you also have a city that's decadent, full of crime, crowded, diseased. So the Roman imagination posits a view of happiness as living in an idyllic country scene on a farm where there's plenty of olives, plenty of grapes for wine, plenty of food, right? A kind of material abundance of security. There's plenty of opportunities for sex. There's plenty of opportunities for friendship. And so, because Romans were experiencing the opposite in their urban material culture. They were experiencing a rise of wealth. Rome was a relatively wealthy place between 0 and 200, but they had all the dysfunctions associated with that. So the point is that humans have a pattern of doing this, of imagining a kind of fictive happiness, which is a kind of antidote to whatever is not satisfying about their existence. And I just wanted to ask you if this rings true today. Can you think of images of happiness in our culture that would be parallel to what we find in Horace's poetry in Roman culture? What are some of our idyllic images of happiness in this culture?
Yeah. Big salary.
Right. So some of our ideals of happiness are urban material conceptions of happiness. And right? Good. What about others? I mean, you see it in lifestyle commercials, right? We have so many images to draw on for this. What are some other images we have for happiness?
Big family.
Yeah, right. So again, fertility, abundance, that parallels the Roman situation, right? Security, big refrigerators full of food, right? But what are some of our other images? Yeah, we have this whole model of a lifestyle. What I'm trying to prompt you for is, what are the idyllic images? What are the visions and fantasies of happiness in our culture that take us away from that urban model of success, like that's parallel to the Roman model? Yeah.
A lot of subcultures start focusing more on simplicity and modesty.
Yeah.
Kind of contrast.
Right. You could definitely see an echo. By the way, some of you might be interested in this. you can definitely see an echo between Horace's emphasis on happiness as a simple life and contemporary movements. There's contemporary movements for simple living, right? There are people who say, and they have pretty interesting happiness argument behind them, that even though you live in a culture of abundance where you could probably produce great personal wealth, you might want to live simply. You know, you might want to live and choose a path that doesn't involve it. So that's very much like this Roman contrast. I was thinking of something much more direct that maybe is too obvious for you guys to point out, but we also have ideals of rustic simplicity in happiness, right? The pleasures of camping, the pleasures of going to a lake, these would be country ideals or contrasts to our urban lives. Because our urban lives, or let's say Spokane is urban to the extent that it is, you know, our regular lives, our 9-to-5 Monday through Friday lives, have a kind of intensity and focus and purpose, right? You guys go from one thing to another. You have really busy lives. That's really cool. I mean, I think we like that as humans generally. So it's not unusual that our contrasting ideal of happiness is escapist. It's to get away from that. And so that's what you find, put in your notes, that's what you find in both Roman and contemporary culture. You find it throughout human culture once we start imagining happiness. Okay? I think it's also just very cool that Roman culture is the only culture I'm aware of that worships happiness as a god, goddess. I think that's just a really interesting idea. But, okay. So let's get into the religious part of the chapter, which is really the bulk of it. And here, what I want you to focus on are really four distinct points in this 1400-year history. So if we can kind of get clarity on that, I think we'll have something valuable in the reading here. Okay. And the first data point is really Perpetua Implicitas. So could you take just a minute and remind yourself of that story? And it's really an image of Christian happiness and suffering. And, you know, the thing to start your notes, and then I'd like some of you to tell the story of Perpetua, you know, I'd like us to produce that story together. But the thing to start off in your notes is that in its origins, Christianity had one of the most radical and innovative novel models of happiness in human history. Never seen before. Really is new. Christianity gives you a model of happiness through suffering. No one ever posited that in human history. The idea is that you can be happy as a Christian because you're suffering like the way Christ suffered for you. Christian communities were powerful in the early days of Christianity, partly because Christians were loyal to each other. They suffered with each other. They suffered through disease. They put higher demands on fidelity on others than Roman culture did. The status of women in early Christianity was much higher than the status of women in Roman culture. So, but fundamentally, the Christian message was that you're blessed you're blessed to suffer for your faith. And you're blessed in your faith to suffer with others. So to be a good Christian is to enter into other people's suffering. That's a pretty novel message historically. And it's a pretty counterintuitive message about happiness. The way to be happy is to suffer with other people? Ah, okay. Well, you get it, right? You get the idea that there's this metaphysics of a God-made man who suffered for your sins. And so that's kind of the model. You know, you have this idea that the image in Christianity is really the crucifix, right? We've got them in every room, right? So this idea of suffering is really foregrounded in Christianity. It's one of the really most innovative things about it as a cultural movement. So what about Perpetua Implicitas? Could we just get the story out? Who were they? They're North African Roman citizens, right? Were they both wealthy? What do we know about Petra and Felicitas? Let's do this together. Didn't you find it interesting that we have diaries? One of the reasons this is an interesting story is that we have internal reflections from Perpetua. She was the patrician, right? Felicitas was her maid. So you have this image of an early Roman Christian who refuses to endorse the state religion, refuses to renounce her Christianity, and her image of happiness, her vision of happiness is so powerful that she'll die for it. She'll walk away from a child she's just given birth to, right? She was nursing a child. And she'll go to a very violent and bloody death, like a lot of Christian martyrs. It's incredible testimony to the power of visions of happiness. And it's incredibly poignant. I know I'm guessing McMahon might have focused on this partly because we have images today of martyrs, right? We have suicide bombers and martyrs, not always religiously motivated. Sometimes they're motivated for political goals. But the point is that an image of happiness can be powerful enough to die for. And the Christian model, while radically innovative, foregrounds the legitimacy of suffering in a way that may facilitate, actually, the idea that an early Christian would suffer for their religion to the point of martyrdom, right? So it's just a very powerful initial image. And any reactions as you guys read this? Do you have any responses you wanted to mention? What do you think? Did you find it an interesting story? In some ways, it's interesting because of how much it changes, right? So let's get some of the other data points in there and see if that stimulates some reflection. So there are three more. The next one comes 300 or 400 years later with Augustine. And Augustine's important for a couple of reasons in the history of happiness. The first is that he consolidates the Christian model of original sin. So Augustine commits Christianity to the idea that you can't get rid of original sin in your lifetime, right? You need Christ to save you, and you need the grace of God. If you're a Catholic, you believe in grace, right, as part of salvation. So that's the first thing. And the implication for happiness from the doctrine of original sin is that you can't be happy in this world. You can't be blessed in the sense of in the sense that you will be if you find salvation. The second innovation in Augustine that's really important for happiness is that he says that Christians, even though they cannot be happy in this world, they can be suffused with the truth of God. They can have God within their soul. There is a kind of happiness that Christians can have because they have God in their soul. They have the knowledge of a future happiness, of conditions for a future happiness. And that is a positive innovation, right? If you're just thinking that your faith is a commitment to the suffering of Christ, this is a kind of positive innovation. So on the one hand, Augustine, make sure it's in your notes this way. On the one hand, Augustine gives us this crushing model of original sin, that you can never escape original sin in this life, which means there are real limits to how happy you could be on theological grounds. But the knowledge of your faith is a source of happiness. It's a promise of future happiness, right? And maybe it's worth pointing out that there was a group around the Pelagians who were going in a different direction. They were early Christians who thought, well, you know, if you did good works and if you really lived the Christian faith, maybe you could get rid of original sin in this life. And Augustine persecuted them as heretics. Right? Augustine was having none of that. In other words, there was a moment in the history of Christianity where things could have gone a different way. You could have imagined a different theology of happiness right at this point if you could imagine that a Christian could become blessed, like a sage, like an ancient sage, right? But that's not the direction Christianity went. I don't have any judgment to make about that. I think that's fine. We're kind of studying this. We're not trying to evaluate it at this level. Does everybody get that? Second step. Are we there? The nonverbal. I go faster if you nod properly. Thank you. That was very good. Okay, so the suppression of the Pelagians may have seemed like a really obscure detail in the reading when you were doing it. It is. But it's a kind of neat tag for the difference, the road not taken in Christianity. One of many roads not taken. After all, big traditions have many crossroads. Okay. The third data point, so this is like 0 to 200. Now Augustine is 400. And now we're up around 850 or something. I'm not sure exactly. The third data point is John the Scot, Erigena. Okay. John the Scot is an interesting character for a couple of reasons. He's doing what a lot of theologians are doing throughout these centuries, and that is he's trying to reflect on how you return to God, how you get to salvation. And okay, it's a little complicated story, but it's kind of cool. Okay, let me just tell you the story and see if you can kind of get it, because it's hard to capture from the text. He thought he found a really cool text, because there was a rumor that Paul the Apostle knew a guy named Dionysius. And Dionysius was purported to have written this text on mystical theology, that you could engage in practices, mystical ascetic practices like fasting and various kinds of physical torments and extensive prayer, that you could engage in mystical practices that would bring you to God in this life. And that would be a kind of mystical bliss. Right? So that's put it in your notes this way. John the Scot theorized mystical theology in Christianity. And that's a model of happiness. The idea that you could mystically contact or get in touch with or find union with God in this life. Wow, that would be so cool. Okay? A slight problem, he based his theory on a text that turned out to be fake. Or not what he thought it was. In fact, the text was from a 6th century Syrian who had been influenced by a mystical school of thought called Neoplatonism. Now, Neoplatonism is a 2nd century AD philosophy that comes about by a mystic named Plotinus. It has a name similar to Plato, so it's very confusing. Neoplatonism, Plato, right? But Neoplatonism comes 200 AD. Plato's back in, 400 BC in Greece. Plotinus is in Rome, in the Roman Empire. So, long story short, John the Scot found a distinctive moment in Christian thinking on happiness by theorizing mystical theology, by theorizing the possibility that you could engage in ascetic practices that would bring you a kind of bliss, a union with God in this life. And he does it because he thinks he's looking at a text that from a contemporary of Paul the Apostle. Turns out he's wrong. It's not Dionysius, so now we call this text Pseudo-Dionysius, because it was a fake, right? But the cool part here is, the story is kind of interesting, but the real innovation in the history of happiness is this idea that you could engage in mystical practice, in ascetic practices, that would bring you a kind of blissful union with God. And that mystical theology tradition continues from that point on. You have it today in Christians and Catholics who have more spiritual practices that are more similar to this. One very strange detail here, though, is the Desert Fathers. Have any of you heard about the Desert Fathers? The Desert Fathers, you can bring this up on your devices if you want to Google Desert Fathers images. The Desert Fathers were ascetics who in the spirit of mystical theology chose to live in the desert on pedestals. Some of these pedestals were 60 meters in the air. That's a pretty tall pedestal. Okay, they were maybe a meter square. And what some of the Desert Fathers, who were mystics, would do is get up on these pedestals and stay there for 30 years. I mean, you know, it's going to take a little... Asceticism isn't for light peaks, you know. You can't be a wimp if you're going to go down this road. And the faithful would hoist food up to the Desert Father and the pedestal. I don't know if they talked. I don't think so. You know, I think the ascetic practice was about being on this pedestal and cultivating this mystical practice to put you in connection with God. So it's a really beautiful, powerful image. It's also pretty bizarre, am I right? It's a pretty bizarre image. But images of ascetic practice, East and West, are usually extreme. That's kind of the point. Ascetic practice is based on the idea that you have to do something extreme to get there, right? Maybe extreme meditation, yoga, prayer, sacrificing pleasures, limiting your freedom voluntarily to a pedestal, 1 meter square, 60 meters high in the desert. Okay? So it's a really important moment in the history of happiness. Not because it's unique globally. I mean, we have examples of mystical thoughts around the world at some point, from cultures around the world. Okay, any thoughts on that? Anybody want to try it out?
No. I don't want to try it out. Okay. The image I'm getting in my head is like, okay, your boss thinks work for, you know, 30 years, and you spend 30 years trying to call them instead of just running a business, like doing something with your life.
So it seems like a waste.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, from our consciousness generally, our cultural consciousness, this just looks like a really bizarre practice. But so would the practice of being a sadhu, right? A mystic or a seeker in an Asian tradition. A sadhu would be a person who just begs for their food every day, and that's part of the spiritual practice, right? For you, right? Am I right? For us, that just looks like somebody who needs to get a job. Okay. Fair enough. Okay, last point, Aquinas. Now we're at like 1300. And it may not seem like much, but Aquinas' innovation is really important. And you should be, especially if you're a Christian, you should be very grateful to Aquinas for his innovation. Okay, let me tell you about it. Aquinas, as you know, is famous for synthesizing Aristotelian thought with Christianity. He's really a major figure in Christian thought for that reason. Aristotle's coming back into the West through the Renaissance, and it's much later that Aquinas does this, it's early Renaissance, Aristotle's coming back into the West and becoming known to scholars in the Renaissance. So people are studying Greek again for the first time. And so this is a flowering of that return of Greek philosophy, which had actually been missing from the West. Aristotle had been missing from the West for centuries through the Roman Empire. So anyway, Aquinas is synthesizing Aristotle and Christianity. Now, we've already studied a little bit about Aristotle on happiness, right? Remember that? Remember that pithy phrase we had from a couple days ago, that Aristotle thought that becoming happy involved realizing your potential, becoming the kind of thing that you are, right? So Aristotle thought that our nature had a teleological structure, our striving for happiness is teleological, those come together in the pursuit of our nature. So you become happy by becoming who you are, by developing your potential. Well, in the Christian models up to this point, there would be no place for that. There'd be no place for a kind of happiness realized on this earth by becoming the kind of creature you are. That's not part of the Christian model up to this point. Your salvation lies in another life, right? So what Aquinas does, which is quite radical then with this background in mind, is he says, we know Aristotle was right to a point. He didn't have the benefit of revelation. But there is a kind of happiness. There is a kind of real, put this in your note, Aquinas argued there is a kind of real happiness in this life. And he argued it as an Aristotelian. So you know the argument, right? He argued we do have an earthly nature. We also have a divine nature. So there is a kind of imperfect happiness in this world. So Aristotle's Aquinas is famous for introducing the distinction between perfect and imperfect happiness in the Christian model of happiness. It's a huge distinction. Because now Christians can, from this point forward, Christians can think about their religious practice as a happiness practice, as a happiness philosophy. And Christianity starts with the radical claim that happiness is found through suffering. So that's 1,400 years. That's a huge turn in thinking, right? One reason to ask you to suffer through a long history chapter is to be able to see this at a glance, right? And that requires this kind of perspective. Okay. Okay, any thoughts about that? Are we good on that? Are we clear? Yes, please.
Is his imperfect happiness progressive? Like, happier?
Yeah, that's good. It's Aristotelian, so it's going to have that progressive dimension to it. That's a really good point. It's going to be, remember we used the phrase, we talked about perfective activities, things you could get better at. So Aquinas is definitely buying into that model of human nature from Aristotle. And he's saying it's appropriate for Christians. It's okay for a Christian to think of him or herself as an animal in this world. That's how God created us. And God gave us a kind of happiness in this world because he gave us, you know, and then you tell the Aristotelian story. He gave us reason, right? Okay. This is going to set up later developments of Protestantism. Protestantism isn't that far away. And Protestants take a distinctly different approach to happiness than Catholics. So we're going to follow that later in a future reading. Okay, are we good? Thanks for that comment. That was a good comment. Any other questions or comments?
Do you think there's some parallel between Augustine and Aquinas? Because it doesn't seem like he was also agreeing that there's some bit of happiness you can experience on earth, but Aquinas is just taking a step farther, like we can have like real happiness, it's just
good.
Just not divine.
It's really hard to compare them because Augustine had Plato as a model, so he had the Platonic texts, and so he's thinking much more in terms of a kind of transcendent, a model of transcendence, where there's a transcendent reality, that's where the action is. But you're right, I mean, the knowledge of it, and this is very Platonic too, right? Plato thought we had a version of knowledge of the form, right? But the knowledge of it is a source of happiness, right? So the reason it's hard to compare them is that when you get to Aquinas, you've got an Aristotelian metaphysics work, which is much more down to earth. Aristotle's the father of biology. They're really working from different metaphysical paradigms, even within classical Greek thought. But yeah, that's a good connection to make.
Absolutely.
Okay. Good. Other? Yeah. Good. All right, let's make a transition to our psychology chapter. Maybe you found this a little higher interest. It is certainly a shorter reading. I know history's a challenge, but this is a totally different kind of text to get into now. Let's shift here. Okay, so we're starting this book. I used to have students buy the whole book. Now we do most of the chapters. And this is Daniel Gilbert stumbling onto happiness. Daniel Gilbert is a cognitive psychologist, and he does original research, but he's also really good at synthesizing research, in this case, in relation to happiness. I recommend that you try out one of his TED Talks. He's a really good TED Talk lecturer, and he has some of this material that's in the book is in a TED Talk, so you would get kind of like a nice version of it in a short talk. Okay. So let's just get into this now. So he makes this dramatic claim at the beginning that, you know, humans are the only animals that think about the future. Can we just start with that in your notes? He qualifies that too, right? So let's just think about what that means. It's not quite true that we're the only animals that think about the future, is it? So let's use a fancy concept. Let's use the concept of time consciousness. Because what we want to do is be clear about what he's saying. He acknowledges right away that, of course, you know, squirrels get, you know, they put away nuts for the winter, and animals have some kind of a time consciousness. So he doesn't mean that, right? He's not denying that animals sequence things and can anticipate things and get ready for things. So what is he saying here? What's distinctive about the time consciousness of humans? Yeah.
I'm trying to find it right now, but from what I remember, he was calling that like a simple prediction.
Right.
Not necessarily like thinking about the future, just they recognize things from the past, and then they know like A happens, so B is coming next.
Right. So it's a more... So this is a much shorter time frame, much shorter temporal awareness. It's maybe a little more driven by stimulus and response. What's dramatic then about, how do you make the contrast? What's dramatic about the human ability? I mean, we get ready for winter too. Storm windows up, right? What's distinctive about humans is we imagine whole futures. You guys are projecting, you guys have in your heads, I'm sure, different ideas about what life might be like in 10 years, 5, 10, 15, how far out are you going? 20? Stop there. Now, there has been recent research to suggest that animals, especially mammals and higher primates, have much more time consciousness than we used to think. So there's really cool research where you give primates, for example, tasks that take a long time that you know how they know how to do, like produce food of a certain kind. And you find out that primates can manage windows of time maybe 18 to 24 hours, and we used to think that their time consciousness was just a few hours. So and elephants, right? Have any of you read about research on elephants? Elephants seem, it's true. Elephants have incredible memories. There's evidence of elephants returning to grave sites and mourning sites of other elephants and engaging in mourning behaviors years later. Yikes. Okay. So you know, you have to be careful about how he's making his point. The crucial difference, and we have no evidence of this in any non-human animal, is that we construct futures from our imagination. You know, we construct whole futures that are designed from our desires, our preferences. So our nexting, because he uses this term nexting to talk about it, our nexting is really, I think it's really at a higher, at a different order of complexity and magnitude. Okay, so let's get into the story about Phineas Gage. What happened to Phineas Gage? Anybody? Yeah.
I just have a quick thought on the animals, human things.
Good.
Thing. Do you think that at all has to do with our life expectancy? And then, like, maybe a squirrel lives 5 years, so all it has to really plan on doing is living its 5 years, and we're, like, planning on retiring and, like,
right,
doing what we've done for however long?
Yeah.
So, like, I mean,
absolutely,
maybe they're doing it at the highest level they're capable of doing it because they only have so long.
Right. But that's not a bad hunch at all. I mean, length of life is probably a big factor.
Or even just like the scale of like planning a year ahead for a squirrel is like planning 20 years ahead for a human.
Right, that's neat. But we do, but you have other animals that maybe live 15, 20 years that probably don't have proportionally.
Oh, yeah.
But yeah, but it's a good intuition. I mean, I think the thing to focus on is the complexity of the brain.
Yeah.
You know, but yeah, it's interesting to think about it being proportional and having to do with really what are your challenges as an organism, right? Absolutely. Happiness in humans is even weirder, but that's a reasonable intuition to make, a connection to make. Yeah, good. So Phineas Gage, right, was this crew leader of a crew of people who were blowing up rocks, and what you do is you drill in the rock, and then you put the explosive in, and then you tamp it carefully. The metal rod, and if you accidentally hit a little quartz down there or something that makes a spark, then the rod can just become a projectile, and that's what I know. It's not a pretty story, and that's what happened to Phineas. And he had leadership skills. He was the crew leader, and he became very dissolute. He got in fights a lot. He couldn't hold a job. So what happened to him, okay, this pipe went from here and it popped out here, and amazingly, 1840s, right? Amazingly, he lives, right? They just knocked the dirt off the hole, put something on top of it. But the crucial thing is his personality changes. And nobody had a theory about this at the time. But now we do, because we've also seen patients with lesions in their prefrontal cortex, prefrontal lobes. We've also had experience now with this horrible but sometimes useful procedure called a lobotomy, where you literally scramble up some of the brain matter. So we're kind of in a position to have a general theory, let's get this in your notes, that the prefrontal cortex, having developed last, is the seat of many of our social intuitions and planning capacities. So that's this part, right? The forehead. Ancestors didn't have it. We have it. I mean, I should remind you that our brains, over the last 2 million years, our brains went from 350 cubic centimeters to 1,200. No, that's like a Harley. It's great. We have huge brains, right? 2 million years of eating meat and cooking. So the general view would be that, you know, we've evolved a part of our brains that does two things. It helps us imagine the future, and it helps us worry about the future. And the thing to capture in your notes is that duality. The same capacity we have that allows us to imagine the future is the capacity that is the seat of our anxiety and depression about the future. Now, I don't mean to assume that you're depressed or anxious about the future, but you see my point. When you give somebody a lobotomy, they become very calm. If somebody has uncontrollable anxiety and other kinds of, I don't know what the diagnostic conditions are for a lobotomy, it just sounds like a horrible thing. But they are still done sometimes in cases that can't be resolved with other means. So you give somebody a lobotomy, they become calm, but they stop worrying about the future. Remember this other classic movie? Have you guys seen this one? One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, right? You should definitely, if you haven't watched that, it's not a happy movie, but it's important. Okay, so are you getting this point? This is kind of a key point here, that one of the capacities we have for happiness is also the capacity, one structure in our brains that gives us a capacity for happiness because it allows us to imagine the future is the same structure that gives us capacities to feel horrible, to feel anxious, to feel like losers, to feel life isn't worth living. And that's a remarkable thing. I mean, other animals don't kill themselves. Humans kill themselves. But other animals don't experience this wonderful capacity to imagine a future that's going to be so great that it's worth working hard for. It's worth planning for. Get up early in the morning for reading, doing all your readings. Being a good person. Okay, we're almost there. Any thoughts on that? There's a couple more details to add here. Okay, so the last detail to add, really. Okay, so we have this. Oh, I did want to read from this one description just to give you a sense of the. Here, this is on page 14. This is the interview between the psychologist and the person who had the head injury that damaged their frontal lobe. And the psychologist is asking, so what are you going to do tomorrow? I don't know. Do you remember the question? Yeah. So there's memory. How would you describe your state of mind when you try to think about the future? Blank, I guess. It's like being asleep. It's like being in a room with nothing there and having a guy to tell you to go find a chair. It's a weird thing. And there's nothing there. It's like swimming in the middle of a lake. There's nothing to hold you up. Isn't that amazing? Think about that. What would it be like if you really couldn't think about tomorrow? It'd be very strange. It'd be a very strange feeling. This person's trying to describe it, having been able to do it before the accident. They're trying to describe it. And it's I find it really eerie and kind of profound in the sense that it reminds me that when I want to complain about my futures that I'm planning, I should catch myself and imagine what would it be like, right, if I couldn't do that.
Can people, or does the prefrontal cortex deal with our perceptions of the past too?
That's a good question. I'm not sure. I think it must, because it's how we manage social reality, and we couldn't do that very well if I couldn't remember you guys from Tuesday.
Right.
And I have trouble with it, actually. But I do sort of remember. You look familiar. It's good. So, yeah. But yeah, it's a good thing to ask about. Because you might be wondering, how could you have a problem about the future without also having a problem about the past? Right. I don't know. Yeah. Okay, so the last thing to add here is really just at the end of the chapter, just make sure we got this together. And it's about control. And let's see, I wanted to tie this in real quick. Let's see. We're gonna read other research about control, but the point to start with your notes is that there's a lot of research supporting the idea that humans can't maintain mental health without having control of their environment. If you want to drive a human being crazy, the way to do it is to take away their feeling of control of their environment. So when police want to get people out of a compound, they put bright lights on in the middle of the night, they make music come on at random times. When you want to drive someone crazy, that's what you do. You undermine their sense of control of their environment. So the study you get here is pretty dramatic, but and I want you to be suspicious about some of these studies. We're going to, actually, there's an issue with some of the studies in this book that I need to tell you about. Some of them haven't been replicated, and there's a little bit of an issue there. But this one, I think, has, and it's a very dramatic study. I'll just read it to you. So this is a study that took place in a local nursing home. I'm on page 21. They told half the residents that they were in control. Oh, so they were giving residents plants. They were putting plants in the nursing home, and they were told half the residents that they were in control of the plants, care and feeding. That was a high control group. And they told the remaining residents that a staff person would take responsibility for the plant, and that was a low control group. 6 months later, 30% of the residents in the low control group had died, compared to 15% in the high control group. Now, that's one nursing home, it's one population of people, so you should really be suspicious about that result, just on the face of it. It's like, so 30 versus 15, like, what does that really mean? Maybe that was just an accident of the people who happened to be there. But there is a lot of research like this, and I think this piece has been validated. I haven't read anything undermining this. There is just a lot of research that suggests that people, maybe you guys can think of a connection to this in your own experience. I mean, can you think of something from your daily life where lack of control just drives you crazy? Can you think of an example? Yeah.
I have to sit through class for 6 hours Tuesdays and Thursdays and drive me crazy.
Right.
Just stand.
Absolutely. No, a lot of people, I felt this when I was a student. I felt the kind of constraint of not being able to get up and go. Yeah, so environments, the rules that tie us to environments give us control issues, yeah.
When you're laid somewhere in traffic and you hit every light and stuff and there's really nothing you can do about it.
Right. It drives me crazy.
Right.
Noise is a big one. If I'm interrupted by noise that I can't control, it's a problem. So humans really crave control, and it kind of goes along with imagining futures, right? Because the next thing you want after you start imagining a future is you want to control the outcome. You want it to happen, right? So the last thing I wanted to read was this quote that comes at the end of the chapter, and it says, look, we're the apes that learn to look forward because doing so enables us to shop among the many fates that might befall us and select the best one. So we're the ones who have this capacity that both gives us a chance to optimize our future by imagining them all there and choosing the best one, but we're also the animal that correspondingly is anxious about which future to choose. and whether it's going to be realized. And I think that's very appropriate to any stage of life, but it's especially appropriate to where you guys are, right? You're in a really interesting point, right, for imagining futures and trying to get them to be realized. And I think people underestimate how much stress is involved in the transition that you guys are facing from being seniors. How many of you are you mostly seniors? You're getting ready to walk the plank here, guys. This is really dramatic. I know, I shouldn't have said that. I'm sorry. It's a big change. And so thinking about your happiness in the coming year in connection with control is probably a pretty useful thing. Okay, let's stop there, guys. Thanks for your attention. Sorry.